All right. This is a new expert to expert, the first one back from my vacation. I'm glad I made it back alive.
Okay.
Now, people know you. They already know who you are, but we're going to say who you are anyway. You're Bart DeSmet.
Exactly.
Linked to everything.
Okay, yes.
Now, last time we had you in this kind of setting, it was an expert to expert with Eric Meyer.
Exactly.
Who, by the way, is now your boss.
Yes, since last week, you know, I'm working full-time for Eric, so...
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Is one hell of a team, man.
Mm-hmm.
So, link to anything. We had that great conversation. And, of course, we're with people today who have done some amazing work with link to SharePoint.
Yep.
Why don't you give us a little introduction of what we're talking about? You're the expert.
Okay.
And with two other experts. Take us through what's going on here.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, actually, before I joined, I did some link to SharePoint implementation.
Really?
Rather small one, minimalistic one, but, you know, like, mainly focusing on query translation.
Excellent.
And, you know, those people here in the office team have actually taken it to, you know, to production now. Like, they've done a separate implementation for the next version of SharePoint.
Uh-huh.
And that will be in Office 14, so.
Cool. So, one question before we do introductions that I think everybody would like to know. Why are you so gung-ho on Link, man?
Okay, yeah.
What's going on?
Oh, yeah, it's, you know, the nice thing about Link is really that you have, like, that separation between, like, you know, the complexities of querying some data model versus, you know, making it easy in VB and C#, also as of .NET-enabled languages. And, like, you can put more smart into the query engine as opposed to have the developer restructure code every time you need to do something, you know, need to change... like the semantics, you know, or not really the semantics, but like the underlying mechanism you talk to the server, or, you know, new query constructs come along in the underlying language, and then you can take advantage of those without having people to revisit every single SQL statement or CAML statement. So
excellent. Yeah. Perfect. So who do we have here today? Let's introduce.
I'm Maxim Lukyanov. I'm program manager in SharePoint team. I work on the link to SharePoint feature, and when we started this feature, we actually realized that there is already SP link on the market, and this name was taken already. So, and Bart was the first one to actually take this name, and we contacted you in the early stages of design, and we actually drew some insights from how you built your SP link.
Yep, exactly.
Excellent.
I'm Ivan Han. I'm a developer on the assistance platform team. I'm one of the developers for Link to SharePoint. I've been working with Maxime on this project.
Excellent. So, you know, without further ado, I mean, what is Link to SharePoint? Give us just, I mean, obviously from the name, we can make assumptions. SharePoint is kind of a large product. What's going on here?
Yeah, SharePoint is a large product. That's a good start for the description of the link to SharePoint. And one of the problems of being the large product is the complexity. And sometimes for developers, it's really difficult to jumpstart developing for SharePoint. And the primary goal for link to SharePoint was to simplify this development for SharePoint and offer beginner developers a simple way to program against SharePoint data.
Okay.
So one of the technologies that we the technology that we choose to actually simplify development was Link, because it has very great integration with C# language and allows you to use IntelliSense to actually specify your queries. And for majority of developers who have experience with SQL, these queries are very natural, looks simple enough to actually write them, and because the Link isolates you from specifics of the platform, you can apply your knowledge of Link to any platform. So that was the primary reasons and goals for building Link to SharePoint.
Cool. And, you know, expert to expert here, Bart, I mean, Brett, forgive me, Bart.
It's Bart. It's
Bart Simpson.
Like Bart Simpson.
That's why you like The Simpsons.
Exactly. Yes, all my co-founders.
Well, your new name is Brett DeSmet. I'm just kidding. Okay, Bart DeSmet is a nicer name.
Thank you.
So, you know, talk to us about your implementation, and let's start digging into some stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Here.
Like, so one of the things that's kind of, you know, what I was looking for when I was doing this link to SharePoint thing was looking for some non-trivial iQueryable provider in Link. So iQueryable is a way to sort of remote link expressions. So essentially you take expression trees, you transform them into some domain-specific query language, if you will. And so I did that with Active Directory, which has very simple, like, filtering predicate mechanisms. And I needed something of more of a challenge, where you really need an entity model, where you really need, you know, sort of a mapping layer and all of that stuff. And so, you know, Camel was ideal because, like, I heard lots of people complain about Camel as the query language used in SharePoint. So, so maybe we should talk about that a little bit, because there's quite some stuff in Camel that, you know, was not allowing me to make intelligent queries at that point, like doing traversals and lookup fields and so on. Like, say you have products and you have categories and a product has a category. You know, if you do a query across, you know, the boundary of product to a category, saying all the products that have a category starting with a B, you know, it became kind of hard to do that because you needed multiple round trips to the server to first get all the categories, then the IDs of those guys, and, you know, get the products that, that go with that. So did you change anything in Camel to sort of facilitate that kind of querying, or do you have smarts in the query provider that sort of, you know, do multiple round trips at certain points when it's needed, or?
Yeah, a nice property of Link is that it makes this very clean model of relationship between entities, and it allows you to do universal queries across this relationship between entities. Mm-hmm. And when we implemented Splink, we had actually a choice either to convert this Link queries into a native, like directly into SQL queries, mm-hmm. or we could convert this Link queries into our native SharePoint query, which is called Camel query. And the reason we had to choose actually a Camel query route is because SharePoint as a product has a set of business logics mm-hmm. implemented in this Camel query layer. It has very sophisticated permissioning model where user access to a particular object and the relationship between objects is determined by permissions that administrator set for this object. So we had to convert this queries into a Camel query because we didn't want to replicate all of this business logic that SharePoint has into a new query processing engine. But when we did this, when we built this link to SharePoint provider, which converts link queries into a Camel queries, we actually discovered that our Camel query wasn't expressive enough to convey this power of link queries into SQL queries. Yeah. And what we had to do, actually, we had a choice between how much of the link queries power we offer to the end users. Mm-hmm. And one of the important elements of the link queries was this ability to, as we described in this example, ability is to query related objects or get a list of entities based on the properties of the related entities. Mm-hmm. And this can be achieved through SQL joins in our, like, exactly. regular yes. SQL queries. And in Link, you can actually specify explicit joins, or you mm-hmm. can specify implicit joins. Yep. Like Link engine is more expressive in this regard.
And it's also the fact, you know, if you do IntelliSense, you know, it's very easy to traverse a chain of dependencies, right? You start with a product, you see a category has a name. Well, why shouldn't I use it sort of, you know, to write a where statement or what statement the class in the query expression? So that's exactly the thing, right?
Yeah, in this terms, Link is even simpler to program for mm-hmm. For developers because it offers you all of the available relationships between entities. So we decided that we'll extend the capability of Camel query mm-hmm. to actually cover for this missing element of this nice model that Link offers. And we implemented join support in our Camel query engine mm-hmm. and integrated this join support from Camel query into our Link provider. So now it is possible to actually use this IntelliSense to specify queries to a related queries to entities based on the properties of the related entities and push it down to a Camel, and then our Camel query engine will translate it into an underlying SQL query and execute this query efficiently.
And also enforce the business logic rules that,
yeah.
that you have.
And in all of these intermediate steps, the permission model of the SharePoint and other business logic relevant to the mm-hmm. Performance operation will be applied.
Yep.
Hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And so when do these transformations take place?
Okay, so I believe Link to SharePoint is an iQueryable provider, right? It uses yep. the iQueryable interface. So essentially you get all the expressiveness of Link for free if you do so, because you know iQueryable is like a very simple interface that has all the extension methods for all the query operators. And all the stitching of the expression trees is sort of done by the queryable extension methods. So what you end up with is like some very big, you know, expression tree that is handed over to the query provider to translate into whatever it sees fit upon the time you enumerate. So you do like get the enumerator, and at that point, you know, you start pulling things out of the server, and at that point you can do compilation to SQL or to CAML or whatever. And maybe you should talk about like how the expression tree translation sort of happens. Like what are sort of, you know, the things that you guys have come across that are, you know, like non-trivial transformations that need to be done in order to translate the query?
Developer?
I think one of the major hurdles we had was to fully translate a link query to CAML due to CAML's limited expressiveness. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we decided early on is to say some queries may not be fully translated 100% to CAML. Mm-hmm. And will result in what we call residual client-side query.
Okay.
So we try our best to split a given link query into first fully CAML query, if not mm-hmm. a combination of a residual client query and a CAML query. We push the CAML query down into SharePoint, get the results, and apply the mm-hmm. residual query on top of it. That was our strategy. Another thing we decided early on was the concept of inefficient queries. Mm-hmm. Where some queries, despite being able to push them down into CAML, result in many round trips to the server due to the residual client query. Mm-hmm. In those cases, we decided to disallow users from executing such queries. If users want to do such queries, they would have to, you know, use two array to materialize mm-hmm. all the results in memory.
Or as enumerable, I guess, yeah. Like to sort of throw it over the wall to link to objects, right?
Yes, and then work with them in a mm-hmm. step by, you know, in multi-step query yep. process.
Mm-hmm. What are the examples of this inefficient queries that we disallow today?
I think one of the prime example is to, you know, if you want to materialize, let's say, all orders of a collection of customers, we can't do that today using link to SharePoint. Primarily because, you know, for every customer, we would result in one round trip to the server to fetch all its orders. Mm-hmm. So users would first have to materialize all the customers into memory first, and then go through each customer and then call, you know, materialize over their orders.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. So like one of the things there is like to reduce the data volume, right? That's sort of, you know, intelligently or smartly sent to the client, because like, if you have a complex where class, say somebody is using some exotic method on string in the filter, the category name starts with or ends with if certain overloads is not supported in CAML, because, you know, you supply like sensitivity of casing, all of that, normalization behavior in Unicode, like. So what do you guys do in such a case? Because like you can't really, you know, filter enough on the server. It might be the case that you get like 10,000 of records back to the client, and you have to throw away like 9,900 or something, because the filter doesn't pass. Like in that case, it seems like you should sort of be conservative and say like, oh, we can't translate that because like it will result in huge amounts of data to be coming to the clients. Is that the case or?
Yeah, so that's where this concept of inefficient queries comes into play, because there are some of the queries that have residual client-side query, which we want to allow for the developers. But there are some that result in a very heavy load to the mm-hmm. server. And the way we differentiate between those two is basically we, correct me if I'm wrong, Ivan, we allow this simple predicates in the web clause that are not supported by CAML query to be processed by the client-side query. And these queries we allow. Is it correct? Yes. So in this case, basically, we do a retrieve like complete set of entities or list mm-hmm. items from SharePoint, from SharePoint, and then we apply these additional filters on this collection. Mm-hmm. So we still will push down into CAML the predicates that we do support in CAML. Mm-hmm. But it is possible that resulting collections that we retrieve from SharePoint will be like hundreds of thousands of items, and mm-hmm. while after the client-side query, we will return to the caller just one. And this will be very inefficient. Mm-hmm. So, but we can do this because we have this second level of defense, which restricts these queries that return too many items from the SharePoint. Mm-hmm. Like in SharePoint, we have the concept of query throttling. Okay. If a given query retrieves a number of items from SharePoint, which is greater than a threshold, we will block this query from execution.
Okay.
So applying this concept to the, our SP-Link provider, this means that you can have this simplified queries with, or let's say, queries that support additional predicates natively not supported by Camel Query, mm-hmm. as long as the original collections that you retrieve from SharePoint does not exceed this threshold.
Okay, yeah.
So we allow additional flexibility for developers as long as they don't stress server mm-hmm. over the limit.
Yeah. And are there like differences between where you execute the client code? Like, say you're close to the SharePoint server, you're sort of almost in process with SharePoint, or you know, a process next to it. Mm-hmm. Like, then you don't have concerns about bandwidth sending like huge amounts of XML to the client. Versus when you're running, like, say, somewhere on a desktop in a network and you need to download things to the client, then you have a different execution profile in some sense. So I think there are two concerns about performance there, right? One is the amount of data you're sort of getting out of the server, and secondly, the stress that you put on the server. And, like, the first one is not acceptable if you use web services or something, but, like, the second one is maybe acceptable to be smarter because you're sort of in process anyway. Like, if you're going to you know, do things, you know, client-side using link to objects, well, the client lives in the server in that case. Like, there's not that much of a difference. Is there some provider model where, you know, things go into the SharePoint database of a web service and it's more conservative versus, like, using the object model and then and it's different concerning, like, the heuristics that I used to say, like, this is inefficient.
Yeah, for link to SharePoint, the link to SharePoint process always lives in the same process as the SharePoint. Basically, it lives on the SharePoint web front end, which mm-hmm. Eliminates the first need, first concern about the amount of data that we transfer from SharePoint. So for this aspect, we're okay, but we have to optimize for the overall load on the server because SharePoint serves like many users at the same time, and we have to ensure that a single query to SharePoint doesn't bring down the server so mm-hmm. it's not serving requests to other users. So yeah. for the scalability reasons, we have to limit amount of load that a single mm-hmm. Link query or Camel query can put on the load, on the server.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe something like about the structure of the provider, it's maybe something more for Ivan to answer in this case, is like you have that iQueryable thing, like you know, you sort of have the expression that you translate into Camel, like how does it translate into an API then? Like does it go into like the object model for SharePoint or does it go into like web service calls over like the paths on VTI bin, you know, there are some ESMX files or something, I believe, there. Like, what's the way, sort of, you know, that from the client, the query ultimately ends up in the server?
So we use the SharePoint server object model.
Okay.
Initially, we had a client mode where we would use the SharePoint client object model. But we have since scraped that in favor of using Astoria. Mm-hmm. So as we know, Astoria can link to a link provider, so that will be our client story moving forward. Uh-huh. So link to SharePoint essentially really is a server-side API that and which uses the SharePoint server OM.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't go through the web service of SharePoint.
Okay, so like instead of a web service now it's REST-based, right? Uh-huh. Because Astoria sort of goes to REST and you know like query travels into the iQueryable provider on the server in this case. Yeah. Well, I think that's nice consolidation in terms of the code. Like my SharePoint provider, like there were two sort of, you know, underlying providers, just like Link to SQL has underlying providers for SQL 2000, 2005. And like those providers have actually the final, you know, decision to make, like how the translation will happen and how it actually is sent to the server. So in this case, like, it seems that that's eliminated because you only have like one way to go to the server there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe another thing, like regarding translation, is like the semantics of the query. Like if you say, for example, you know, you want all the customer records that were created after daytime.now or something, like, or you know, daytime.now minus 5 days using, you know, subtract 5 days for the time span. like it's always tricky to do that kind of stuff because datetime.now, like the user writing it in C# says, well, datetime.now is clearly the system clock on my machine versus like the thing that you want to execute on the server. Like, does the link to SharePoint provide like to preserve the semantics of like all the things in .NET and local clients so that so much, you know, information is sort of pushed to the server that you get exactly the results as if you were downloading the SharePoint database and then, you know, sort of filtering it locally using link to objects. Like, what are sort of, you know, translations that happen to make that work in case that's the semantics that are being used?
Yeah, for SharePoint, as Ayman said, our link to SharePoint provider is a server-side programmability story or server-side API. And SharePoint server-side object model has this established contract about how date times are processed.
Mm-hmm.
And the contract is very simple, and maybe it is not suitable for some of the advanced scenarios, but at least it's easy to describe. We always use local time of the thread in which the query is executed. And when request comes from the user, this thread context is established in a way that it represents the current local time of the website this user is connecting to.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
the thread culture actually represents the current time of the user in the context of their website.
Mm-hmm.
And this time is used actually to pass down to the SharePoint SQL server and the appropriate time zone modifications are done in this translation, but it's
okay.
done at the level of the SharePoint server object
mm-hmm.
model. And as an interface to the server object model, we always use local time that was specified by the user.
Yep.
So in this regard, the translation for link to SharePoint provider was simple, just
mm-hmm.
use the time as it is given in the local form and pass
yep.
it down to the SharePoint server object model.
Yeah. So datetime.now sort of snaps the time on the client and
yeah.
then sends that to the
yeah.
server.
Yeah, and in this case, the client is SharePoint web front end because
yeah.
we are on the server side.
Yeah,
and,
I see.
And this web front end thread is configured in the
mm-hmm.
way that appropriate for the current user that is making the request and the,
mm-hmm.
and its current website.
Yeah.
Now, what about, just to interject,
uh-huh.
I've been doing a lot of stuff on Channel 9 recently with, you know, the advent of hosted services, right? So SharePoint has a hosted service.
Yeah.
Are there implications with this model when, in some sense, you're just targeting some cloud where you expect there to be
mm-hmm.
a SharePoint server and the object model that you already had on premises that you when you developed your system? So that's really just my question. I mean, does this just go over pretty smoothly? Does that make any sense, the question?
Yeah, I guess, let me rephrase the question. So how SharePoint link to SharePoint provider can be used in the client,
yes.
cloud, and what are implications or problems in this area.
Thank you. I'm still on Hawaii time, man. I get so full of aloha, and all this, you know, technical stuff is not important on an island. So please,
great.
Thanks for rephrasing. But that's exactly what I'm asking.
Yeah, SharePoint offers SharePoint Online hosting service,
mm-hmm.
and this is basically SharePoint Cloud, where small businesses, small and medium businesses, as well as corporations can host their SharePoint websites.
Mm-hmm.
And SharePoint Online uses new feature of the SharePoint Office 14, which is called Sandbox Code. This allows developers to basically upload their assemblies to SharePoint hosting service and to let them run in the sandbox environment inside of the cloud.
Okay.
And the nice property of this thing, of the sandbox model in SharePoint is that it's exactly the same server-side object model programmability story as on-premises SharePoint has. And it supports a link to SharePoint provider, and you can basically take this code that works in your like corporation servers and upload it to the server, to the SharePoint Online server,
mm-hmm.
and have it run in the cloud. So
beautiful.
Exactly the same assumptions and
yeah.
semantics of the
mm-hmm.
Object models are preserved.
Excellent. Link to cloud.
Exactly.
Right on.
Yes.
That's your next big thing.
That's something you should do in
right
Seattle
on.
For sure. You know, like see about
especially. Well, today it actually brought some of the aloha spirit back. Right?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen that.
Because it's sunny today, so you're
yes.
welcome.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. Continue.
So yeah, like another thing, like sort of when we talked about datetime.now, it's you know, we're evaluating that thing on the client, right? Whatever the client means in that context due to a story and, you know, sort of remoting that's happening there. But are there other things where you sort of do partial evaluation of, you know, parts of the query locally? Like, meaning you have some part of an expression tree and you see like this doesn't depend on any state on the server. Like you do, you know, like string concatenation or something client-side, and you know all the things are client-side, maybe coming in through closures, like from outside the query where somebody has like a field that says, you know, the name I want to filter on, and that's stored in a string S, and then you're doing like where the name of a customer equals S. Like you're capturing something from the local state. Like, do you traverse that kind of expression trees, or do you say like, this is all local, let's compile that to IL, and then, you know, sort of execute locally, and then sort of feed the constant into the server, or like, are there different translation mechanisms there?
Yes, so some cases where, you know, like you said, local variables, you want to filter based on the values of local variables. Mm-hmm. We do fetch the values of the local variables, evaluate them on the client side, and then pass those values down to the query engine. But let's see, expressions like, what's a good one? Can't think of any right now. But there are some expressions that may be too complex that we today we don't try to get too smart about it and try to push it down to the server.
But for example, just to make it clear, if I have a local variable is bound to the query, and if I execute this query once and then change the variable value and then execute the query a second time, the results will be different, dependent on the actual value of the variable.
Yes, so we actually keep track of the values of these local variables, and then we check our assumptions before executing the query again.
Yeah, like that ties the whole thing back to the fact that link is lazily evaluated, right? Like it's at the point you get the enumerator, at that point you know you need to see what the expression tree refers to, because it might be referring to like some closure of a local variable and that thing might have changed. So you sort of preserve that kind of stuff. So how much of the query plan, like if you execute the same query like 15 times and like none of the local state has changed, like you sort of have already built up like, you know, the camel query. Do you guys reuse that, or you know, make it even more efficient, or you know, like is there some intelligence that you know sort of can reuse queries, maybe even based on the results, tune them? Like that's very exotic, maybe, but like say that a query is very efficient about doing things remotely, like you might sort of adapt your strategy and how you execute the query subsequent times. Like how much of the existing intelligence is reused across execution of the query?
So one of the things we do is we have a collection of assumptions. These assumptions are usually values of local variables. So once we have compiled the query in an earlier attempt to execute it, we check our assumptions, and if the assumptions are all still hold true, we will not compile the query again. But we do not do any like further optimization of the query that has been already been compiled.
Okay. So, like, I think the querying story is kind of, you know, sort of, like, we know how that works now, but, like, as you sort of talked about, like, Astoria and REST and all of that, we have that thing called OData, with, you know, updating semantics and everything. Like, is it the case that you get your entities? Like, maybe the first question is, how do you get the entity objects? Because they live in SharePoint, you have lists there, and, you know, like, you want to have some .NET object, a POCO, plain old CLR object that actually has, like, all the fields and properties. Some are get-only, other ones are settable, that kind of stuff. And then once you have that data, like, can you update it on the client and how sort of travel changes back from the objects to the server?
Yeah, this was one of the challenges with our original plan for Astoria. Basically Astoria provider model supports three types of providers, and initially it supported just two. It supports entity framework provider and plain reflection-based provider, which you can basically supply your structure of entity classes with their properties that may represent relationship between these entities, and let Astoria basically build your data model out of these classes. And the problem with this was initially that we needed to compile basically on the fly these classes that represent structure of the SharePoint list, and then only after this completion state, you can supply these classes to the Astoria provider, so it can build this data feed out of them. And this was a problem because in SharePoint, it is very frequently happens that end user can customize schema of the list and add or remove column from the list or change the column type. And when this happens, we had to basically recompile these assemblies. And the nature of .NET is that it now allows you to unload assembly once it's loaded in the app domain. This is a problem in this scenario when you have like a very large SharePoint site with thousands of subsites, and every subsite has like tens or hundreds of lists. In this scenario, you can end up with like a very large number of these stale assemblies that are still preserved in memory. So this was a scalability problem, and fortunately, Asturio team offered new provider model based on the iData provider interface, which actually allows us to submit or describe the schema of SharePoint lists to Asturio in a dynamic way, which doesn't require compilation of any code or creation of the .NET classes. So it relies on a set of basically classes that allows us to describe using regular .NET objects, allows us to describe structure of the SharePoint list schemas. And we use this iData provider interface to actually enhance our link to SharePoint provider, so it now understands not only basic .NET classes as entity types, but also understands these resource types required by iData provider interface of Asturio to basically do queries and data mapping from SharePoint list items to these resource types in Asturio.
Interesting. And the querying story is the same in that case? Like, and it seems one is sort of, you know, very statically compiled where you use tools like, is it ASP.NET or something that sort of generates the entities? The other one, you have that resource type. Is that like, you know, something that's purely server side, you know, where you do the mapping into like the link to into the camel queries at that point, it's sitting on the server, or is that something that, you know, gets exposed to the client and then you have to access the data in a different way, like using indexers or whatever? Like, is the typical way to get the data like a plain .NET object, and that's the way to interface with SharePoint, or are there different kinds of, you know, ways that you need to use in certain cases? Like,
yeah, this story becomes more interesting and more like complicated in some ways, because now this Asturio provider that lives on the SharePoint web front end, and the interface between Asturio provider and link provider is this resource types, which are dynamic and doesn't require any fixed schema. So in the process of communication between Asturio and SharePoint, we exchange these resource types and we exchange schema and data in this dynamic form. But when Asturio providers itself talks to the remote clients, it sends this data in the Atom feed format, and on the receiving end, where developer builds their bridge internet application using Asturio clients, they can build, and usually it is the primary development story, they build this proxy class that represents structure of the SharePoint list in a, again, in a strict or fixed schema of the .NET classes.
Okay.
So basically the programming model on the client side is the same or very similar to a regular link development model, where you have entity classes with fixed schema, with properties, which have names of your columns in SharePoint list or databases. And you can use IntelliSense to program against this data and perform some queries. In addition to this like fixed schema, the dynamic nature of Asturio data feeds also can be used, and Asturio supports this concept of open types. So even if after you compiled your classes on the client side with a schema that matches the schema of your SharePoint list, and even if end user has added some additional columns to your SharePoint list, you can still access these additional columns using these open types. It's like a property bug attached to the to this entity class on, on your client side code, and you can still access these additional properties and work with them in your client application without the need to recompile your client application.
That's what Eric would call like static where possible, dynamic where necessary, because like you have your static type that's based on the schema, and maybe you're not updating that like at some point because, you know, the list has changed and you don't want to redeploy to all the clients, but you can still, you know, query against that generated assembly by using that additional dynamic kind of behavior, right?
Yeah, that's very interesting compromise between strongly typed classes and dynamic nature of the data.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting aspects to explore there would be to experiment with some dynamic languages, because they will offer even more kind of natural mapping to the dynamic nature of SharePoint.
Because in .NET 4, you know, you could have like a dynamic meta object as the base type, and then, you know, you sort of dot into like price, and price doesn't exist as a static property, then, you know, it would automatically end up in the property bag and become dynamic data, right?
That's a very interesting experiment that we should conduct with our work we have done for Story and link provider.
That's one kind of dynamicness. That's dynamicness on the level of types. Like, is there also dynamicness on the level of the data itself? Like, say you get like a whole product list down to the client, and you want to say, I want to update all the products, and, you know, make the discounted price like twice as large as it used to be before. So I want to do effectively an update using some simple loop or using a data get control where I've bound the data to, like, what's the path that changes on the entity objects go back all the way to the SharePoint database. Like, I imagine there's updating kind of camel construct as well, where you say, like, this entity has changed that field, and you sort of send that to the server. Like, does that path first of all exist? Like, can you update like the SharePoint entities you get back in .NET objects and then sort of persist the changes? And like, how does that work exactly?
So updating of entities do not go to camel. Instead, we use the server OM directly.
Okay.
So this item.update, we store the original values of the entity on the entity themselves. We do conflict detection, because SharePoint's conflicts basically just throw an exception without telling you what the conflicts are. So we had to build a conflict detection around SharePoint. But yeah, essentially we do not use camel to update entities.
But so like the change sort of happens on the client, you know, you're sitting there and you're .NET object, like, what's the exact path that sort of followed to get the change from that client, the remote client, all the way to the server? Like, you're changing something, it does, I guess, I notify property change to sort of record the changes. Are those recorded in, like, a data context, like a link to SQL? And then, like, how do you say at this point, you know, I've updated, like, thousands of items, now I want to sort of send the batch of that thing to the server and get, as you say, the conflicts back to the client? Like, is it like you go to data context and say submit changes, and then certain magic happens, and sort of what's the magic behind that?
So we encapsulate a state within each entity. So whenever the user changes a property, the state basically marks the entity as being dirty. We can also record those dirty entities on the data context. So when the user does submit changes, we actually know which entity were dirty, and we will collect them, change the corresponding list items to reflect the new values, and then submit them to the server. If the server throws a conflict exception, we do a member by member value comparison, report the conflicts back to the user. One thing to note is that unlike D-Link, we do not have transactions. So if you submit changes, there is no way to, and if there is a conflict, there is no way to revert changes that have already been gone through.
Interesting. And that's likely because that's deeply rooted in like the way SharePoint deals with data, right? It's like, unless there's a SQL server underneath that, it doesn't mean that it exposes like transactional semantics all the way through the object models, right?
Yeah, the business logic layer of SharePoint is quite thick, and it offers like a lot of functionality, and it is optimized heavily for the primary scenario of document sharing and collaboration.
Yeah.
And the trade-off was made towards the performance of these operations rather than complete transactional semantic of every operation that you can do with a list items or documents. So SharePoint in general does not support like arbitrary transactions. The atomic operations in the object model of SharePoint itself are transactionally isolated, but SharePoint doesn't offer the flexibility to developers to specify beginning and end of the transactions.
Yep. Okay, well, there are a couple of other things, I guess, that I should sort of, you know, touch on. It's like, you just said, like, you know, SharePoint is, like, meant to be a storage for documents and, you know, unstructured storage. And, like, if I remember correctly, you know, the document library is also a list in SharePoint, right? Which has, like, authors and review dates and all of that data associated with it. Like, is it also possible to expose that, like, say, because there are common list types, I should say, like document library, picture library, tasks, calendar, I don't know, like maybe there are other ones. Those are sort of common, like you sort of could create like a static type for those that's sort of fixed. But in addition to that, like that's just regular mapping, there's also some kind of blob attached to it, like a document that's attached to an entry in a document library. Is that something that the library also exposes through Link to SharePoint, that you say, get the attachments to a list item and I want to get them on the client? Or is that something you need to do additional API calls for in order to say, like, I have a document that has this name and then call a separate web service or something to get the binary data back? Is that like a separate step, or is that included in the object model?
So in terms of attachments, so you touched on multiple elements of SharePoint kind of data structure or data model. So first, you mentioned that there are common types between libraries in SharePoint.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Document library contains documents, picture library contains pictures. So this concept is captured with a content type concept in SharePoint, and basically every library or list in SharePoint contains single or multiple content types.
Mm-hmm.
And every list item has its specific content type.
Okay.
And content type defines what is the available set of fields on this item.
So it's like a fixed schema in some sense,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Basically, the content type defines the schema of the item, and the library is kind of a collection of, can contain multiple types of items, items in it. So Link to SharePoint provider has an advantage of using this information or exposing it directly to the developer. Like when you use ASP.NET code generation tool, but the code that you'll receive or the entity classes generated for you will be based on the content types defined for the lists and libraries in SharePoint.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use like such operators as a type of and is in your predicates in
So you can say things like from
query.
The library get, you know, everything that's type of picture.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. So basically you can manipulate with these entities based on their content types, mapped to your .NET types.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this aspect is well captured in Link to SharePoint.
Mm-hmm.
The other element of SharePoint that you mentioned is attachments and basically document streams. So this additional data about list items that goes beyond what usually databases offer, or something like additional value or value add of SharePoint.
Yeah, that's like, you know, that's like, to put it in the SQL domain, that's like the file stream innovation there, right? You know, it's like you're saying, you know, I'm pointing to some unstructured storage, it's not sitting in the database, but you can traverse the chain in order to get to the data by sort of using the database as a facade to also the blob storage. Like,
yeah,
it's very similar.
Yeah, so for this additional kind of functionality of SharePoint, we have different approach in Astoria provider for SharePoint and in Link provider for SharePoint.
Okay.
So Link provider for SharePoint has this advantage of being in the like developer hands. Like developer can extend the entity classes generated by ASP.NET. Developer can specify custom code that adds functionality to the code generated by Link to SharePoint by default. So we use this to basically cover this scenarios when developer needs to access attachments or document stream. We provide iCustom mapping interface in our on our entities, which can be used by developer to actually extend the entity classes and map additional properties or aspects of the SharePoint that are not captured by default by Link to SharePoint provider.
Mm-hmm.
For example, attachments are not mapped by default into entity classes, but using iCustom mapping, developers can map these attachments into the properties of the entity classes.
Yeah.
The same is the document stream.
So the idea of iCustom mapping is something like, if you guys get an entity back, if you know all the data that you guys can populate, then you do some call on the iCustom mapping to say, like, this is the underlying SharePoint object model object, and then, you know, you can do whatever you want to sort of populate additional data.
instance.
Yes, yes, exactly. During the materialization of the entity out of SharePoint object, we make calls into our custom mapping interface, so mm-hmm. developer can do additional mapping based on the real underlying SharePoint object. Yep. And during the serialization or update of the SharePoint object from the entity object, mm-hmm. we make the same call to do the reverse mapping from yep. the entity object back into a SharePoint native mm-hmm. object. So this is a story for link to SharePoint, yeah. The server-side story. And for Astoria mapping, we actually don't have this luxury of extending the interface with a custom code because it's a web service and yeah. all requests are just given. And mm-hmm. There is no simple way to extend our web service's custom code. Uh-huh. So for the Astoria interface, we actually do support natively attachments and document streams in the interface itself. So developers can use this Astoria client library to very easily program against SharePoint and use all those advanced features as attachments and document streams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, we touched upon the topic now of like, you know, doing mappings where, you know, you have some kind of extensibility specifying custom mapping and that interface. Like, how does the main mapping sort of work and how much can you sort of influence? What I mean is, like, if you take a look at Link to SQL, for example, what they do is they generate like properties and they generate like notification callbacks every time something changes, and then you have partial methods where you can inject like business logic. Does Link to SharePoint follow the same model there, or are there differences in that regard?
We follow D-Link quite closely, so our classes mm-hmm. generate extensible methods. We have partial methods on them.
Yep.
One of the things that we give users is the parameters capability, parameters file to ASP.NET. So by default, ASP.NET only generates properties for each field. Certain fields, for example, hidden, will be ignored by ASP.NET. Mm-hmm. Certain fields like only exist on the list and are not part of any content type. And since classes are based on the fields of a content type, those fields will be not generated by ASP.NET. So with the parameters file, users can specify, you know, force ASP.NET to include hidden fields, for example, include fields that were not part of the content type. So they can shape the class generations mm-hmm. using the parameters file. But aside from that, you know, post generation, they can do manual updates to their any classes using mm-hmm. partial methods and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing of partial methods is that you have them in a separate file, right? So that if you regenerate, you know, the main file, the entity classes, you know, you're not stepping on the toes of your manually created code. Right?
Yes.
That's the whole idea there. Yeah.
Yeah, the same with parameters XML file. Mm-hmm. It is separate from the actual generated classes, and
yeah.
it's separate from the schema of actual SharePoint list. So you
yeah.
can regenerate your class entity classes using the same parameters file
yeah.
and take
mm-hmm.
additional and reflect all of the updates to the SharePoint list schemas
mm-hmm.
From like in the updated SharePoint site.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. Yeah, so you can also
mm-hmm.
like sort of generate your entity classes and then populate a SharePoint database with that? Like, is that the kind of thing? Like, create database semantics that does exist or that doesn't
no,
exist?
No, create database semantics don't exist. But
okay.
In, like, just one of the limitations of Link to SQL,
mm-hmm.
SQL method tool is
yeah.
that the parameters file or the DBML file
yes.
that represents
uh-huh.
the schema of the entity classes basically reflects all of the data in from the database.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if you have updates to the database, you need to update your DBML file. And
yeah.
if you have
mm-hmm.
customized the DBML file, you will lose this customization.
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah.
that was a disadvantage of this approach. So in Link to SharePoint, our parameters XML file does not contain any information about the schema of the SharePoint lists. It only contains user customizations. So that allows us to decouple parameters file from the actual schema of the SharePoint site. So you
mm-hmm.
can use the same parameters file to generate entity classes from the updated SharePoint site. So
I
you
see.
Can make it part of your build process
mm-hmm.
and effectively you will generate entity classes with all the fresh information about the schema of the SharePoint list
yeah.
without changing your parameters file.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like, you know, sort of the opposite of what I did with SPMetal originally. Like, you know, my SPMetal thing was like SPML, like just like DBML, like only that many ticks you can play the acronyms, right? Yeah. So, and there was a single file generator in Visual Studio that sort of, you know, automatically generated the CS file for that. Do you guys have like integration in VS for that, or is it more like just go to SPMetal and execute it and get a code file and just add it to your solution?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any built-in tooling integrated into Visual Studio. You have to basically use SPMetal manually. You can, of course, integrate it into your build script, and that's quite straightforward. But there is no magic button in Visual Studio which says, "Oh, just generate link to SharePoint classes for me for the SharePoint."
But somebody could extend Visual Studio.
Yes, exactly. And new Visual Studio.
Bart?
Visual Studio.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Listen, man. You know,
tonight.
What are you doing this weekend?
No plans. Yeah.
Poor Bart.
Yeah. And the good side is Visual Studio 2010 offers very great extensibility story with new .NET extensibility framework.
Yeah.
So it should be quite straightforward for developers to extend. Extended with some new nice tools.
Perfect. So we should wind down.
Yeah.
You know, we could just keep on talking about this forever.
Yeah, definitely.
But let's you know, you're the expert here. Let's have some conclusion questions.
Okay.
How's that sound?
Well, you know, I think like if people sort of already know like Link to SQL or, you know, existing providers, this feels very similar. I think we agree about that. Like similar way to generate entities, similar tooling. Despite, you know, the fact that it's not MVS, but like SPMetal is the same as SQL Metal, right? And then, you know, you have that whole story layer in there, which is like sort of nice in order to do that remoting story to, you know, like sort of keep the query processing pretty close to the server, to the camel. Maybe one finishing question there is like, you know, you guys are generating camel and sort of sending it to the database there, like to the SharePoint database. How does debugging work in that case? Like, you know, like Link to SQL has a log property, which is very handy to sort of see what's happening. Like, you guys have an equivalent to that? Because, like, I sort of like to learn, like, what the nasty tricks are that people are playing. Like, you know, like a very simple SQL statement or a link expression, I should say, and then, you know, you see, like, a huge SQL expression coming out of that, and you can sort of see, oh, you know, there are some inefficiencies here, and I could maybe tune things manually. Do you guys have a logging story for that, or is that sort of, you know?
Yes, we don't keep any secrets here, and we have the same log property that Link to SQL offers.
Okay.
And you can attach to it and see what are the camel queries we generate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like camel is kind of, in my opinion, voodoo. Like when I sort of look at the schema, it's like, you know, it's very verbose because of its XML format, and it's kind of, you know, nasty to write it yourself. And, you know, we've seen like tons of tools out there of people building like camel builders and camel constructors and whatnot. Yeah.
Yes, now Link to SharePoint is actually a very good tool to learn SharePoint camel query language if there are some people willing to do so.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you could actually, you know, even, you know, do some trick in Link where you have like a WHERE overload that takes in, you know, an entity and then produces an X element, because then you can write it using VB. Like I had a sample where you simply do like from X in products WHERE, and then you paste on camel query, select something, and, you know, like you still have a link statement, but, you know, like it translates into exactly that camel framework, which was kind of, you know, a cool demo for VB. Like it's just a little idea there.
Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent. Now, you know, SharePoint, one last thing. I mean, SharePoint is, I mean, as a, you know, observer of this, I mean, you know, as we've gone around Microsoft over the years, I mean, we already have a rather amazing database, SQL Server. You guys have essentially built your own database. But the reason for that is because you don't need to be a general purpose of something like SQL Server. In other words, you don't have customers that are writing super complex stored procedures hitting, you know, lists. I mean, you have a couple types, right? I mean, we have a SharePoint that we use for Channel 9, believe it or not. That's usually updated, you know what I mean?
Yep.
But the point is, you know, you create a calendar, you create a list, you create a document folder like you were talking about. Just for the people out there that are asking themselves, why don't you just get rid of the whole camel intermediate layer and then just build on top of a, you know, some sort of type of SQL Server, SQL Server Lite, which we can't call it anymore, or whatever you want to call it. Instead of writing your own, because we like to do that a lot at Microsoft. But you have good reasons, so I'm just trying to add that, throw that out, pointing at the developer, who's shaking his head.
I think one of the goals, I'm not sure if you want to talk about this, but
yeah.
One of the goals is to eventually, for SharePoint, to get rid of CAML.
Completely. This was not said.
This is not being said.
That's cool, man. I mean, we don't need to get too far out there, but you know, it's a historical thing. It's a historical thing. It's a historical thing. I mean, there's a lot of MLs out there, man. I mean, how many MLs do there need to be?
Oh yes, yeah.
Right. No. That was like sort of the promise of XML, right?
Yeah.
The X was sort of like extensible.
I was thinking about F sharp and O
CAML. Oh no. But even because when you said CAML, I was like CAML. Oh CAML. What's
yeah, so
man, this is really
about
interesting.
Functional language.
But that would be kind of cool. Functional language over. Well, actually, with Link2SP, mm-hmm. it is functional. Yeah, functional happening underneath the covers,
exactly.
Whether or not you realize it as a .NET developer writing in C#, it's functional programming.
So it's linked to CAML and it's functional.
Elements of functional programming,
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, hell, great to talk to you guys.
Okay.
And awesome work. And you're a great expert host. You're going to come back.
Okay.
We'll do probably link to God knows what. Link to M.
Link to M, yes, I've seen
link
people
to God knows what.
Exactly, yeah.
When we talked about it, people should go back and watch the interview to understand why you can do link to virtually anything.
Exactly, yes.
Perfect. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very
guys.
Much.
Excellent job. Cheers.